Joseph Bellinger versus the State of Minnesota. Council, you each have 15 minutes for your oral argument. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We're happy you're both here, and you got here safely. So at this point, when you come up to the podium, please introduce yourself and your client.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Christopher Persky. I represent the appellant, Joseph Bellinger. The matter comes before the court today on the district court's denial of a post-conviction petition following an evidentiary hearing. When this case came before my office, it was presented by the petitioner, the appellant already, as one for newly discovered evidence, ineffective assistance of counsel, and another more clarification claim. It became apparent to my office almost immediately that the facts of this case are not necessarily one that fall within the law's definition of newly discovered evidence, even though the evidence may be, in fact, newly discovered to appellant. That is why this appeal is based upon an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Now, it is true, and the record will reflect, that appellant had already raised on direct appeal and ineffective assistance of counsel claim, arguing two points that were directly made by trial counsel in the closing statement, in its closing argument, and in with respect to a jury instruction. The issues here before the court today are new and germane, and should not be barred by the NAFLA doctrine, as it's well known in Minnesota law. Instead, the issues that were presented to the district court at the evidentiary hearing involved the expansion of some video evidence, and there were two discs. And disc one was a limited disc, I'll call it that disc one. It was a limited disc that had trial exhibits that were entered here in Beltran County before the jury by the state. Defense counsel, trial counsel never manipulated the video evidence at any point in the defense, either to cross-examine or to in its case in chief. The second disc, disc two, which was brought in.
What could I ask you? I want to get right to it. Wasn't this just a matter of trial strategy? I mean, because what was it on the disc that made or broke this case? Because it showed him apparently walking out with an arm around one of the guys. Well, I don't think anyone disputed that. And they may have had different reasons why that was occurring, but no one disputed that. So, and the other thing is, whether he got in one car or another, does it really matter? I mean,
because
most of this crime, I mean, a lot of the assaults took place at these homes that they were in.
And Your Honor, you raise a very valid point. And initially, when I watched disc one, when I watched the state's disc, I thought the exact same thing. And I talked to my client about it. I said, do you really want to go forward with this and this? When you look at disc two, and disc
is that
two,
the car?
That is, well, that disc two is actually a little bit more complicated. It is a real time dashboard or database.
It comes from more than one camera.
That's exactly correct. There are about, I'm going to say, six, seven, eight, nine different cameras that run. So at 1:21 a.m., you can click on any one of those cameras and see what was going on at those points in time. And I do agree with the statement that there is video evidence of the party arriving, engaging, and all of them leaving, including the victim, Mr. Jeremy DeMar. The testimony, when you compare the video on disc two to the testimony, that was where, especially at the evidentiary hearing, the distinctions were attempted to be made.
Is there a conflict between that video that has the multiple cameras and the rest of the trial testimony?
There is a significant distinction between that testimony in two particular areas. When you read the transcript, the trial transcript in its own, you would assume that based on the way that the witnesses described the testimony, two cars pulled up and the group came out together, and the victim was forced into one vehicle with the other vehicle following immediately, and then a departure. That was the way it was initially presented. And when you read the transcript, disc two, there, what ends up happening is the vehicle in which the defendant is seen getting in with some of the other members of the party. And coincidentally, there was no, some of the other issues or facts that are not in dispute, or there was an offer of proof at the evidentiary hearing. There is no wishy-washy misunderstanding or questions as to who the individual actors are. The video was specific enough. Defendant was identified and was acknowledged. These other parties and other actors were as well. So that's very important, because when we get to disc two, I'll represent to this court that disc two shows from one camera angle the car pulling up, defendant getting in with some of the individuals and leaving. The victim, other individuals, are then seen for minutes, literally many minutes, wandering around the parking lot together or separate at the Palace Casino. Victim, who was forced from the casino, is off on his own for a period of time. What ends up happening after a significant period of time is they come back, three individuals come back together near the entrance, they start walking, and it's very difficult. I can see it in my mind's eye, I'm trying to describe to the panel what the video represents, but it's difficult. But the camera angle is up above on a corner of a building, and individuals, the victim and two other individuals who are not the defendant, there's no claim that it's the defendant, or not the defendant, are seen walking towards the camera at another end of the parking lot. They are then seen, the defendant or the victim, it's very noticeable, left with a hat, a baseball hat on. That was how we identified the victim, Jeremy DeMar. He, after milling about in the parking lot, he then has the hat in his hand, and would appear to a reasonable person, it would appear that he has something in the hat in his hand. He then approaches a darker vehicle, a different vehicle than the one that defendant was seen getting into and leaving. It's important because there's a color or a contrast distinction, a light vehicle, a dark vehicle. And the video is able to identify what that other vehicle, this darker vehicle, was. Victim approaches, leans in the window, and chooses to get in the back seat while the other individuals get in. It's important, and I was asked just a minute ago if there's a contradiction or a distinction in the trial testimony. The victim indicated that he was forced into the vehicle, blindfolded, and held with a knife that he had to leave. He was forced by a knife to his throat at that point in that vehicle. There could not be...
I'm saying the second disc does not corroborate any of that?
That's correct. And that information was not challenged or brought in by defense counsel. And it was, I was asked, I believe, you know, what does it matter, the stuff was in there? It was a trial strategy. And I believe our case on appeal would be weaker if there hadn't been an indication from trial defense counsel earlier in the proceeding that he was having difficulty manipulating some of the evidence that was being presented to him by the state on disc.
By manipulating, you mean accessing what was on that disc one?
Accessing is a better word than manipulating, yes, accessing the information. At a pretrial hearing, we identified in the record There's a pretrial hearing in which he was asked, have you had a chance to go through the documents? And he says, well, I can't get my computer to open the files yet, but, you know, hoping to.
But he already brought an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and he was aware of this at the time. I still don't know how he could be unknowable about it.
Well, two things. There was evidence in the record that appellant specifically requested the file from the attorneys, and he gave the discs at that time. He is incarcerated in prison, so he doesn't have daily or free access. It's quite a arduous process to have disc.
Well, right, but you're arguing it was the manipulation of the discs that fell short of trial counsel in terms of representing your client, and he knew that at the time of, the way I heard you explain it, he knew that at the time of trial that there was difficulty. Are you saying he didn't understand what was within it? I mean, there wasn't, you're not claiming you weren't given the documents.
That's correct. No, that's why a newly discovered evidence argument is not brought.
So he's had the evidence all this time.
His counsel did, yes. And the disc one, the evidence disc that would have been available and entered into and played in court was cut down significantly to just snippets.
Sure, I understand what you're saying, but it sounds as if you're saying, well, this would have exonerated him, or, I mean, you had a chance on the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and to me that was just right out there.
Well, and that, we touched on it in our written submission, as a practitioner, I should be probably wary making this statement, but I guess it delves into an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. What is the responsibility or the obligation on appellate counsel to review?
Claim. You didn't make that claim to the trial court.
We did argue it. We touched on it in the written submission. I believe that there was that argument available, or that it might have been required. We acknowledged the difficulty to the district court. We acknowledged the difficulty in trying to say that appellate counsel was ineffective for not having pored over every scrap of evidence in discovery, not just what was in the file.
You know, I still don't know why all of this matters. I mean, maybe I'm missing it, but I think the evidence was, and they had the jury obviously believed the testimony that he left. You know, that at some point they exposed a knife to him, and he was scared, and he went with this group in the car and ended up being basically assaulted over a period of time, and at various places. So I don't know, what does it matter which car he got in, or whether the knife was immediately held up to him at the time he got in the car. I mean, if in fact there's ample evidence submitted that he was the victim of a continuous assault over a long period of time.
It's a very good question. It raises two points. Number one, there was an issue. It matters in that witness's credibility and the believability of the victim. You hate to blame the victim or attack their credibility. I understand, especially given these facts that were alleged and found by the jury. But the video evidence does not show someone in fear or coercion, or it really, that's part two, that other video really shows, frankly, to be candid, that this court shows someone that's ready to go engage in a drug transaction, a sale, or use of some drugs or something. The other part is, if the court's question holds water, and it doesn't, you know, what difference does it make? What does it matter? Then this evidence, this video evidence, was irrelevant, or was highly prejudicial as compared to the probative value. What I'm saying is, if it, in the district court tried to parse it into the situation that the Palace Casino is not located in Beltrami County, the jury found that some of the events at least did take place in Beltrami County. And my question is, well, then why?
Did you object to disc one?
I'm sorry?
Did you object to disc one?
Did I object to disc one?
Not you, but did.
Not trial.
No, no. In fact, the trial transcript indicates that it was played and by the state, and then that was the only time it was used.
And to the extent the failure to object would have been something that could have been handled in the first appeal. You seem to be weaving in and out of, you know, things that marginally are new, but much of it has really all been there for a long period of time. And I'm, in my own mind, trying to sift out how much of it is really new enough so as to not be canonical of art.
If I may, I know my time's going to expire, so if I may complete.
You may complete your sentence.
Thank you. And the when the jury heard the testimony from the victim that the defendant at the Palace Casino, the defendant put a knife to his throat and drove off with him, and that video evidence that we're brought to that post-conviction shows that the victim did not get into a car with the defendant, and that could not have happened. That situation now, here, outside, without the pressure of trial and without the weight that is put on counsel and all the participants.
Did your client testify?
He did not. Oh, I appreciate the extra time, but I'll conclude. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, you have 5 minutes to reply.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Mr. Persky. This court must affirm the district court's decision to deny post-conviction relief petition. And thank you, Judge Hooten. My name is Dave Frank, and I have the pleasure today of representing respondents.
Oh, okay.
So thank you.
Thank you.
This court must affirm the district court's denial of appellant's post-conviction relief petition in all respects. The district court first correctly determined that the petition is NAFLA barred. We all know the rule under NAFLA. If a direct appeal has been taken from a conviction, all issues presented and all issues reasonably that could have been presented are here and after barred from any attempt to get through the post-conviction relief afforded under Minnesota statute section 590. The NAFLA rule is particularly significant when it comes to claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. I would direct the court to page 19 of my brief where I go through the Torres case and the Carradine case, which stands for the proposition that a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel that can be decided on the trial court record must be raised on direct appeal or is procedurally barred in a subsequent district court petition for post-conviction relief. When the court applies that clear law to this case, it has to come to the conclusion that the petition was not the bar. The record in this case demonstrates that all issues of ineffective assistance of counsel were known to appellant during the trial and immediately after. The surveillance tape that Mr. Persky went through was available to defense counsel. It was available well before.
Beg your pardon? Tool?
Yes. Everything that Mr. Persky referred to was provided to defense counsel during
disc
the discovery process.
A compilation of parts of disc two, is that right?
That is correct. And it can be a little confusing when you go through disc two. It was confusing for everyone who looked at it, but it was available for defense counsel to parse out whatever relevance that it had. So that surveillance tape, both disc one and disc two, were available well before the trial in October 2014. Furthermore, appellant was, and this is an important point, the appellant was aware of the issue because two of the state's witnesses testified that Mr. DeMar was wrong when he claimed that he was in the vehicle with the appellant, Joe Bellinger. The state's witnesses testified to that. They were the appellant's co-defendants, John White and Bobby Jones. They testified that the victim was absolutely correct when the victim went through how he was tortured by them and the appellant at the residence in Beltrami County, where the bulk of the confinement took place. That's where the kidnapping really took place, was in Beltrami, not Cass. So the defense was on notice that the state was bringing this issue. That was in the record. We had two witnesses testify that the defendant was not with the victim when they left the Palace Casino in Cass County on that March morning. In fact, trial counsel highlighted this discrepancy. Counsel for the appellant highlighted that discrepancy during closing arguments, as they should have. So, and this is the fact that appellant glosses over. So the points complained of in the petition for post-conviction relief were actually presented during the trial. So when the court, and more significantly, although known by appellant, this issue should have been raised during the first appeal. The ineffective assistance of counsel was raised by the state appellate public defender, as this court may recall, in 2015. But the issue that they identified, presumably because this claim of the tape had no merit whatsoever, was that the appellant did not, or appellate counsel during the trial, did not receive an authorization to acknowledge that they were guilty of a lesser included offense. That issue was presented to the Court of Appeal. Court of Appeal said, you know what? There was no admission under the circumstances. So we are denying that. But that's where this issue should have been presented. And under Nafla and Carradine and Torres, this court really has no choice but to affirm the district court's determination that the petition was not for barred. The record also makes clear that appellant can't show any of the three exceptions for NAFLA preclusion. First, that the case needs to be reopened to develop some claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. Second, if there is a novel issue presented. And third, in the interests of justice. Again, the tape and the ability to cross-examine investigator Howland were available to the defense well before trial. Appellant did not need to reopen the case to locate some new evidence. Secondly, there's nothing novel about a litigant complaining about that trial counsel did not take a satisfactory approach to cross-examination. And the interests of justice don't require it. As Judge Rutan indicated, this is just about trial strategy. And I would ask the court to review pages 22 and 23, where I go through the Jones case of 1986, that Minnesota Supreme Court case, which articulated that such decisions on which witnesses to call at trial, what information to present to the jury, and are questions that lie with the proper discretion of trial counsel. Reviewing courts shouldn't go in and second guess trial counsel afterwards. Particularly as it relates to the line of cross-examination, the state asked the court to review the Anderson decision on page 23, which held that modes of direct and cross-examination and whether or not to pursue a line of cross-examination are best left to trial counsel. As a result, this court should not be reviewing it either at the district court level in post-conviction or at the appellate level. Finally, even if appellant's post-conviction relief petition was not procedurally barred, under the Strickland standard, he still is not available. He still does not have the relief available that he requests. This court, like enough, rule is well versed in Strickland versus Washington. First, the defense must show that trial counsel performance fell below an objective standard of reasonableness, and second, that the outcome would have been different but for trial counsel's mistakes. As it relates to the first prong of Strickland, I ask the court to go back to the Jones and Anderson standard about appellate review of trial court strategic decisions. Jones and Anderson stand for that proposition that it is not the province of the district court on review or the Minnesota Court of Appeals to go over with a fine-tooth comb and over trial court strategy. That is not the type of issues that Strickland gets
to. And as I understand it, it wouldn't have made a difference with regard to venue, because part of it occurred at the house located in Beltrami.
That's correct, Judge Hooten. Quite honestly, if the court looks at the kidnapping statute, it can either be confinement or removing one person to another. Those are two separate standards and two separate tests. The state argued both during the trial. The state argued that you can just look at the confinement at the residence within Beltrami County. That's all you really need to focus on. Quite frankly, that's where the worst aspects of the terror took place with both of the victims, both Mr. DeMar and Ms. Lash. If you just look at that, the only thing that happened in Beltrami County are the only relevant issues. Quite honestly, the state also argued that second prong, where the victims were removed from that residence, not the Palace Casino, but the residence in Cass County to the Beltrami County residence itself. The state did not really argue that the kidnapping of DeMar took place. I mean, reference to that, but the state's focus was on the incident that took place at the residence in Cass County, but more so the incidents that took place at the Beltrami County residence. So consider Jones and Anderson. Also consider the fact that, bringing up that video that Mr. Persky referred to, ladies and gentlemen, that's the state's evidence. Why do you ask? Because that evidence corroborates the testimony of two state witnesses, the co-defendants, Bobby Jones and John White. Remember, those were the two individuals that said, you know what, the victim actually got it wrong. John White and the appellant were in one vehicle. Bobby Jones, Jared Bosworth, Darlene Lee, they were the ones with the victim, Jeremy DeMar. They put in the vehicle to go find Rachel Lash, the person that allegedly stole the methamphetamine and the money. It was a good decision for defense counsel not to play that tape, because that tape corroborates critical state evidence. Good strategy, not bad strategy. So, the court considers that first prong of the Strickland test, the appellant just doesn't need it. And then, it wouldn't have made any difference anyway, not only because of the reasons that I've already articulated, that the incident at the Palace Casino was really a sideshow. The bulk of the evidence, and the evidence that proved that appellant was guilty of kidnapping, took place at the Beltrami County residence. Consider all of the evidence that the state relied on. The testimony of the two victims who brought us back to that day and told and informed how much terror they felt when they were waterboarded by vodka, tied up with duct tape, threatened with death. And that was corroborated by Bobby Jones and John White. When the court considers all of the evidence, including statements by the appellant on jail-recorded phone calls, admitting to much of this evidence, that was also played for the jury. When the court considers that, under the Strickland test, defendant falls woefully short meeting that. And as a result, state is simply requesting that this court find that Judge Schlucker did not abuse her discretion when she denied the petition for post-conviction relief. Thank you. And I yield the balance of my time.
Thank you.
The issues raised by the state just a few minutes ago, and in their argument, caused a few thoughts. The first is that, you know, it's been argued that appellant should have known this video evidence existed. I don't think it's, we aren't saying he had it in his possession. We are saying that it was part of his trial counsel's file. We agree with that. However, based on that video evidence that we're discussing today, appellant would have only been aware of certain contents of the video or what it might have looked like, which would have only been the parts of the video that he was present for.
At the post-conviction hearing, did the defendant's trial counsel testify?
He did not. The issue that we discovered was in a, let's see, I'm looking at this. April 4th, 2014, this is part of the record, page 3, trial counsel explains to the district court, I have some digital evidence, including a disc that says two statements that my software does not allow me to access, and another disc that indicates there are 8 statements therein. Likewise, my software has not allowed me to access that statement. So we identified that there was some trial counsel was having issues accessing and using the digital.
So the defendant was present during this hearing?
During that hearing, yes, absolutely.
He was present. There were two discs then.
I don't know that we are, well.
I mean, he was present to hear this discussion by his counsel that there were two discs, and then he couldn't access some of them because of his computer.
That's true. I don't know based on.
It shouldn't have come as a surprise to the defendant that the second disc surfaced.
Well, based on what, this was a pretrial hearing well before. They're still talking about discovery and whatnot, so I don't know that we can here today conclude that because the two discs were referenced on in that hearing were the same two discs that I was speaking about, both the exhibit disc that was entered in trial and the larger discovery disc. That quote was more intended to show that the trial counsel was having difficulty actually accessing the digital.
But it's still there as a in front of the defendant to know that there's more than one disc and they only introduced one disc at trial. He could have asked, where's the other disc? He apparently didn't.
Again, we don't know that they were talking about the same discs.
Were there more than two discs?
In the discovery file, yes. Yes, there were multiple. And so I don't know
whether the newly emerging disc was one of them that he's referencing.
That's correct. But based on his complete failure to utilize any technology during the trial and access those, his appellant's argument that he wasn't able to actually play the discs and watch the video, and he relied on the state to do it at trial.
If you're not reciting that as some ineffective assistance of counsel, no. Right?
That was...
But he didn't get equipment to be able to do
it. Oh, no. No. I apologize. I misunderstood the court's question. That would have been
clearly canonical barred.
That would have, and that type of issue falls squarely with counsel. If you're not able to actually do discovery, we probably need to bring that to the court's attention before trial. The other issue, when we were talking about the facts and the horrific things, that were done. We understand that this, today's discussion and the petition on post-conviction only applies to one victim, Mr. DeMar, and the charges and the sentence that was imposed on the, by the district court for those events that, affected Mr. DeMar. And based on the video evidence that was available in discovery but not utilized by trial counsel, it is appellant's position that here in post-conviction that the jury could have and should have probably found him guilty or of a lesser charge or not with respect to Mr. DeMar. I appreciate the court's candor and consideration today, and thank you very much.
All right, thank you, and we appreciate you being here, and we will take the matter under advisement.
Just remind you that we're all heading back toward the city, so don't run us off the road.
I'm driving a white minivan, not known for its...